session number 12217, Reel 1.
Mr. Lang, Reel 1. Can you tell me where you were born, please?
In Muswell Hill, London, North 10.
What did your father do for a living?
My father? What did he do? He was in the wood business, mainly designing big staircases and supervising the erection of wood, timber work.
Did you go to school in Muswell Hill?
No, I didn't, actually. I went to a small school in New Southgate. And after that, I went to a technical college in Tottenham. And after that, I went to the Northern Polytechnic, and I was studying to be an architect.
Did you get into the architect's profession?
A friend of mine and myself, we changed to be, to quantities of our training after about 2 years, and eventually I decided after about 4 years I wasn't interested, and he carried on, and he became a quantity surveyor, but I didn't. I went into advertising after that.
How did you come to be in the RAFVR?
That's an interesting story, actually. I was walking down at the Strand, and there was an RAF recruiting office there, a window with posters in the window, and it said London businessmen join the RAF and fly RAF airplanes at weekends. And that's exactly what I did.
Was it patriotic reasons that impelled you to go in?
No, I wanted really. No, there was no sign of a war. It was the fact that I was interested in mainly in motor racing, at Brooklands and Donington, but it's such an expensive sport, I couldn't possibly afford the cost of a decent car. There was no sponsorship in those days. It was all privately owned. And here we had this wonderful opportunity of flying these super airplanes provided by the government. And that's exactly what I did. I flew Hawker Hind, well, first of all, Tiger Moth. I actually had my first flight at Brooklands, for which I'd paid, I think, 10 shillings. And I had the luck, good fortune to be flown, or taken up in a Tiger Moth, by a very famous aircraft racer called... His name was Ken Waller. And I thought it was such a marvellous thing to be able to do. And I was hooked from then on, and I just wanted to fly.
Would it have made any difference to your decision to go in for the RAFVR if you had thought a war was imminent?
No. No, that's part of the deal. If you join the RAF, even though you're only flying at weekends, you sign papers to say that you are a member of that service, and whatever they ask you to do, whatever happens in the future, you will do.
What was your reaction when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
This happened before that. I mean, it was about June, July, 1939. Then myself and others, we knew that a war was imminent. We knew, so we packed up work, And what I virtually did was able to do was fly practically every day at Stapleford Abbots, where I was in Essex, the aerodrome that I was attached to, and really just putting more flying hours in and getting more and more experience. Although we weren't then being trained for war, all we were doing is learning to fly better and better and being more efficient at that job. And then on September the 3rd, of course, when the war broke out, I was immediately called up.
Did you know very much about the German opposition at that time?
No, none of us did know. And, of course, we weren't really trained for war. Although we were flying at that time, sort of 1925 to 30 war-type aeroplanes. They were Hawker Audax and Hawker Hinds biplanes. And then when we were called up, we were flying similar machines, training for war.
What was the first operational squadron that you went to?
73 Squadron in France. But then that was when all the balloon would burst. I mean, they were desperate for pilots, and we were completely untrained for war. I mean, but that was to our advantage. So because we didn't get killed. We didn't do stupid things like many of the regulars did in those days and got themselves killed. Because I think that they, as I've talked to quite a few regulars since, and they felt that they had, that was what they'd been trained to do, and they had to do that, you know, that show their ability. And of course they got, many of them got killed stupidly. But we came along and learnt the hard way. We just found out by our own guile and ingenuity and skill what it was all about, to keep alive and to be able to fight the next day and not get killed. So, and not to have accidents. So many people had stupid accidents. But we were, I think, we'd been trained in the hard theatre of city business life, and we hadn't been living in RAF messes. We'd been living at home.
So you felt that was an advantage to you?
Well, subsequently, I'm sure it was. I didn't know that was an advantage at the time, of course. I mean, we were completely ignorant of what was going on. In fact, my first trip was, it's in my logbook, I arrived in France, and before I was posted to France, I did a lot of training at a FTS at Westfrew in Scotland, and our chief flying instructor, incidentally, was Lord Douglas Hamilton, and who incidentally gave me above average ability as a pilot at the end of the course. And from there I was posted in I think about April, early April 1940, to a ferry pool ferrying aircraft to France, because there were so many losses. When the losses started at the beginning of May, they had to quickly establish a ferry pool of new vast number of pilots to ferry new airplanes to the front line in France. And I was on that job, and when I came back one day, I was asked by our CO at Cardiff, where the ferry pool was situated, Cardiff Airport. And his name, incidentally, was Squadron Leader Taffy Jones, a 1914-18 war fighter ace. I think he had the VC, actually. And he was our CO. And he asked us if any of us wanted to... I'd flown a Hurricane once and delivered a hurricane a short distance, about 50 miles from St Athan to Kemble, I think it was, in Buckingham, in
Gloucestershire.
And I landed it twice because I got lost on the way, and I found it the most exhilarating experience. It was out of this world. It was like what I can imagine would be like driving a Formula One car. That was the first time I landed, taken off in this aircraft, Hurricane Mark One. And the amazing thing was nobody was able to show me how it worked. I had to find it out myself.
Why not?
Well, I was delivered by the ferry pilot, like we all were in Nansen, about six of us in Nansen, being dropped off at various aerodromes throughout the Great Britain to pick up aeroplanes and fly them down to Andover aerodrome and then across to the Channel to France. And I was dropped off at St Athan, and there was nobody there that could tell me anything about the aeroplane. The fellow that pressed the button on the starter battery, I said, "What do you do?" He said, "Well, I'm an air screw expert." I said, "Well, you know something about this air screw? I've never seen one of these before." And that was a constant speed air screw, which wasn't in general use at that time. This was a brand new aeroplane, and it hadn't got to the front line, which was later. All the aeroplanes in the Battle of Britain from September onwards had this marvellous new air screw. But anyway, that's another story. And he was able to show me how that operated and tell me. Otherwise, I was still being able to fly it, but anyway, it was no problem. I'd been flying many types of aircraft at that time. I'd flown battles, which, well, if you like, it's a medium bomber, two-place medium bomber, but it could have been similar. It was rather similar, but a different make of aeroplane. But anyway, you picked up all this very quickly. You had to. I mean, there weren't the people to train you. There was no such thing as the refresher courses on new types of aeroplanes. You just went and flew them, and that was it. You're told, there's the aeroplane, it's got to go to San Jose. You're given a piece of paper that gave you the delivery note, more or less, where to deliver it to, and that's what you did. And then I was asked by Taffy Jones one morning, with many others, very early in the morning when we used to go on parade, would we like to go to France, a fighter squadron, anybody? And I was one that stepped forward and went straight out to France and landed at the aerodrome. And in the afternoon, Cobber Kane said to me, "You're in my flight, fly this." And this was a wooden air screw, one of the original Hurricanes with a wooden air screw, single bladed wooden air screw. And I just flew it around the aerodrome. That was the second time I flew a Hurricane. And then the next morning he said, "You're coming with me to ground staff of German aerodrome." And six of us went off, and lo and behold, three of us came back.
Can you describe in detail what happened on that operation?
Well, we just dived down onto a lot of swastikas that were ME-109s that were parked around an airfield, around a field, and we just fired our guns at them. Shot across the aerodrome and fired at all the aeroplanes.
How much destruction did you wreak?
No idea. A lot of destruction. When you've got eight guns, and there were six of you firing 1,150 rounds per minute from each gun, you do an awful lot of damage. But we don't stop to look to find out. I mean, we're only about 10 feet off the deck, or 20 feet off the ground. You can't make mistakes. You just fire at them and use all your ammunition and go. Get out of it. But lo and behold, only three of us came back from that.
Were you conscious of the German plane's petrol tanks going up?
We'd pass that. We were doing about 250-300 miles an hour. It's not like that. It's a few seconds and you've It's all quiet again.
Were you conscious of any ACAC fire?
Oh yes, that's going up. That was the first time I had that, but I wasn't really conscious of it. But that was what got three of my friends.
Was your own plane hit?
No, not as far as I know.
Do you know where, which aerodrome it was that you attacked?
No, I can't remember. It was near, our aerodrome was at Gay. It was near Eshameen anyway, that's where all the battle was going on, Eshameen.
Where is
it? It was after the, well, it's in the middle of France, really. It's really the old 1914-18 war battlefields, you know. It was just after the Maastricht Bridge debacle, which 36 ferry battle bombers were sent to bomb Maastricht Bridge, and only one got back, and that was flown by a Flight Lieutenant McLaughlin, who later joined us at 73 Squadron when we were in England.
Did he tell you and about the Maastricht Bridge attack?
No, we never talked about things like that. It was only another trip, and he got back. His reaction would be the same as mine. You go across there, don't do your job. And all those 35 didn't get back. I mean, in my instance, as I say, 50% of us only got back. That was my first action. But the remarkable thing was there was a pilot officer, a New Zealander, pilot officer, oh dear, oh dear. Hiram Potts, that's right, Hiram Potts. And 3 years later, after that incident, after many battles later for me, I was shot down and became a prisoner of war in Germany. And Hiram Potts was waiting at the gates of Stroglov 3, which was the famous RAF prison camp in Germany, Kriegsgefangene Schaft, as it was called. He said, I've been waiting here for 3 years for you to come.
How did the losses of your comrades affect morale?
Not a bit. When I say not a bit, I mean you just had to go on. It was your job to do this. By that time, I realised even that, you know, this is a war. There's no sort of going back and saying I'm not going, can't do it or something. It's silly.
But did you think you'd be the next one, or did you?
Oh yes. That's not quite right. You never think it's going to be you next, but eventually you can see a deterioration in one of your pals, in their manner, or they're not quite the same person that you knew, and it would appear that they're losing the motivation to carry on or something, although they probably wouldn't know that themselves, and you think, oh, poor old George. I don't think he's going to last long, and very often he didn't. Somehow, we had this, I'm rather short of words for it, but this, I suppose it's adrenaline, the cause why this adrenaline rushing through you. You were in this state of euphoria, which wasn't real, but it was very enjoyable. I mean, you went along to the pub in the evening and you were fated by all the local people after it got dark and they bought you drinks and you were always very happy. And that, it went on like that. I went on 3 years like it.
But what signs would your comrades show when they were beginning to...
Oh, they're morose and quiet and unhappy or something. Non-talkative. You know, a person that was... He wasn't his normal self, that's all you could... But maybe I'm just imagining it. But we used to think... agree that poor old George is not quite with us today or something.
Did you come across this phenomenon that they called in the war lack of moral fibre?
Oh, Lord, yes. We all suffer from that, don't they? Anybody that tells you they didn't, lacking moral fibre. Have you ever been frightened?
Many times.
Have you? I've only been frightened once in my life. And I wouldn't call it, that was nothing to do with lacking in moral fibre. The only time I've been frightened in my life was when I finally shot down, after 3 years of war, over Crete, when I'd been chased for half an hour by six 109Gs, Messerschmitt 109Gs, that were 50 miles an hour faster than my aircraft, and I had no guns. I was a PRU, number two PRU from Cairo headquarters, and I was doing photographic reconnaissance, and which very often took 6 or 7 hours in a Spitfire. The wings were all fuel, and there were no guns, there was no room for guns, and I couldn't fire back. They were firing at me, and six of them were intent on getting me. But I didn't I'm not saying I was frightened while the action was going on, but I eventually crash-landed it. I was being chased across the east end of Crete, around the mountains, by one machine eventually. And I was chasing across an olive grove, and I went through one or two trees, and knocked the tips off the air screw, only just the end, and the vibration was so great, and I was right down on the ground, and I skidded along the ground at about 250 miles an hour. Now, eventually it stopped after mowing down lots of olive trees and so on. And I got out of it because I wanted to set light to the thing, because I obviously knew I was going to be captured. And I had cascades, all I can remember, and talking about, you asked me if I've ever been frightened, was when I landed and got out of the aeroplane, I had cascades of water going down my back. That was fright, and I've never been frightened since, and I've certainly never been frightened like that before. And yet I was shot down 5 times, you know.
So that was in 1942 that you crash landed in Crete?
Towards the end of 1942.
Coming back to this LMF business, did you actually come across people who had to be pulled out from flying because
no.
of so-called LMF?
Never. Never. We all sort of said, come on, wake up, tomorrow's another day. We'd go on. It wasn't like that. It was just we were very, very close. And there was no sort of officer, sergeant, ballyhoo, none of that. We were all in the same boat. And it was a marvellous camaraderie.
Did you ever make wills?
No.
You were never advised to make wills?
No. We used to have visits from, we used to have a squadron psychiatrist, but we found that we could send them round the bend completely in about 2 weeks. They left in tearing their hair.
Why?
Well, they asked questions, and they got... they asked what we thought were stupid questions, and they got stupid answers.
Can you remember what kind of questions?
No, I can't. But I still have no faith in psychologists. I would never go to one myself. I think I know how to deal with my own brain far better than anybody else.
Was there a psychiatrist attached to each squadron?
Seemed to be. They wanted it. They couldn't understand how one kept going and doing this sort of thing. Because it was so new. I mean, it never been done before. Well, at least 1914-18 war was probably very similar. In France, we were living and then reliving the 1914-18 war. It was absolute hilarious in its stupidity.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, we simply have to be told to do things that, to go and do things that nobody in their right mind running a war would tell you to do, because you weren't going to come back from it. And eventually, that's why I didn't come back from my last thing. I pleaded with HQME in the Middle East to let me delay my flight for half an hour, because they'd already sent another fellow to find this special ship with an escort just south of Piraeus. And I said, well, I shall only run into his fighters. Let me leave it for half an hour. They said, no, you can't. It's imperative. I said, but you may get the pictures back from the other fellow. And they said, well, we must send two aeroplanes to make sure we get the pictures back. Well, he went back and didn't. He didn't get the pictures. He didn't. I got the pictures, but didn't get back. And I ran into his fighters, which I knew I would do. I knew I wouldn't come back. But you can't persuade. I mean, that's, you'll be put on a charge for lacking in moral fibre and court-martialed for not doing what you were told to do. And all I asked, delay it for half an hour. And they said, well, we can't put on landing lights at Marriott Aerodrome, which was Alexandria, for you to land in the dark. I said, I don't want any lights. I'll land in the dark without lights, because Marriott and Alexandria was being bombed every night at that time. And they said, well, we can't put lights on for you. Anyway, as I say, they didn't get the pictures, but I had them in the aeroplane. I got it. I found the ship. I took the pictures and was on my way back when one and I flew over my head, coming back out to sea, this was, south of Crete, on the way back to Alexandria across the Mediterranean. And there these bloody 109s flying over my head. And they suddenly recognised that I wasn't one of them, and then they started interfering with me. They were 2,000 feet above me, so they were able to dive down and attack me. And I had to turn back and turn in circles to avoid them. And that went on for half an hour.
Coming back,
and then I had nowhere near. Dreadly, you start a fight like that over that area, you know, that far away, 500 miles away from base, you haven't got the fuel to get back. You can't get back. My idea, what you've got to do is try to get to Turkey. And incidentally, in the aircraft were papers in an envelope selling that aircraft to the Turkish Air Force if you landed in Turkey. And not only that, you were then put in prison for 6 months. Well, no, put in prison. And you were expected by the Air Force, the Air Ministry, this is an unwritten law, to escape and get back to Palestine from Turkey after 6 months. You had to do a period which was more or less arranged with the Turkish government. But not only you, but the German Air Force, exactly the same thing. So consequently, you met German pilots in Istanbul when you climbed out of the window. But this is what we were told. And I had two or three friends that were actually in there that were shot down on doing the same sort of thing that I was doing. But they were actually...